Let me tell you the area I worry about most. And I do worry about this an awful lot because we do at PGI and some of the work we do see it rising. If one looks at the exploitation, and there are two elements to this. One is the exploitation of young, vulnerable people in the area of exploitation.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, we bring you the second in a two-part conversation between Steve and Brian Lord, currently the Chief Executive Officer of Protection Group International. Prior to joining PGI, Brian served as the Deputy Director of a UK government agency governing the organization's cyber and intelligence operations. Today, Steve and Brian discuss the proliferation of mis- and disinformation online, the potential security threats posed by AI, and the need to educate children in cyber awareness.
Let's turn a little bit now to looking forwards, because I did want to talk to you about 2024 being a very big year for elections in large parts of the world, not just in the UK, but of course across the EU, the United States. And you mentioned this when you were giving an introduction there. What do you see as being the primary cyber threats during such a big election year? What is the greatest concern? You know, is it something like direct interference, hacking, or is it a little bit more indirect, such as disinformation campaigns? Where do you sit on all of that? What should we be looking out for?
It's a very good question. I think that it all depends upon the motivation of those who wish to disrupt an election, if you like. I think high impact attacks on electoral systems, in terms of the voting mechanisms, if you like, are still quite difficult, still relatively rare, but also only ever have a delaying effect, right? So you can, and it is complicated. If you wanted to majorly disrupt an election by attacking an electoral system, and you have to bear in mind electoral systems, certainly the UK, are not totally and fully automated. There's a lot of automation there. But if you look at other nations, they are rolling out automated electoral systems. Or you will only ever delay that, right? You will create confidence in the electoral process itself. But if you have to delay because of a cyber attack, you're only ever going to ever delay an election. It's extremely hard to do. It's extremely hard to do at scale. And the guarantee of an attacker getting it absolutely right at exactly the right point is very high. So it's a fairly complex operation for a short-term hit. We shouldn't take our eye off it because it is disruptive. And for those adversarial states who have a quite sort of nihilistic foreign policy, if you like, just creating disruption in and of itself can help. The disinformation and misinformation campaign, I think, is a lot more longer term. I think it's a lot more malicious. And I think we should really take care about that. And the reason I say that is because there is a temptation when we talk about mis- and disinformation to immediately jump to the role of AI, which I'm sure we will come on to into a moment. But the main concern about mis- and disinformation campaigns is good, successful mis- and disinformation campaigns take a long time to plan, really quite a long time to plan, take a long time to see the effect, and tend to take the element of picking up on what we call wedge issues. Generally, misinformation, disinformation campaigns very rarely start with something completely made up. They normally pick up on wedge issues. And in the UK, one could say immigration is a wedge issue. It's one of those things where thought is generally tends to be polarized. There's not really that much in between. And therefore, through a variety of means, they tend to accentuate that polarization of thought, which creates a lot of distortion of the truth, distortion of opinion, and as a consequence. So I think, one, you get the mis- and disinformation, which can manipulate the way an electorate can vote or should vote. But as a consequence, you then create societal tensions as well, particularly when you're talking about major wedge issues. And I think one can point to the US elections of 4 years ago to see how that can manifest itself. So I think mis- and disinformation is a very deep endemic problem that will be made worse by the advent of AI, but is actually quite damaging in itself. And I will go back to the US elections of 4 years ago to see how actually that kind of mis- and disinformation can manifest itself in the real world on the streets as it did on Capitol Hill. The reason that is more impactful than a cyber attack on an election is because you are actually shaping human beings' opinions and their views, and you are polarizing them. in a way which does create societal, you know, if you are got a fairly nihilistic foreign policy, if you are trying to influence an outcome of an election, you're going to get a far longer term impact by doing that than you are by a singular cyber attack on the electoral system, which would damage confidence in the electoral process. And so if we look at, as we are a liberal democracy, we believe in the rule of law, we believe in democracy, and we believe in a societal approach, I think we in the West, and bear in mind different nations have different risks, but this can fundamentally undermine the principles of democracy. An attack on an electoral system won't. It will disrupt an election. Mis- and disinformation, systemic mis- and disinformation, can actually have a fracturing of a societal approach. And I think we should care about that particularly more in a very significant way.
No, I agree with you completely. And I think social media has a huge role to play in all of that area. So how can people try to differentiate between what is misinformation, disinformation, and what is real? I mean, any sort of tips there, any advice?
Well, I think the thing is, and it sounds sort of, I almost sort of go back to sort of my old history teacher at school, goes, oh, check your sources, kind of thing, right? But I think there is an element about that. There is such a proliferation of information out there, right? That, you mean, we live in the internet world. That's not going to go away. There's freely available information of various different levels of provenance. And I think if you are a thoughtful digester of information, if you are a thoughtful digester of opinion, well, first of all, you should become aware of those wedge issues. And I think there is always, you should, when taking time when digesting information, particularly information from the internet, whether that's through social media feeds or even other sources on the internet, is actually it is worth taking a little bit of time to actually check the provenance of. Now, there are two ways you can do that. Is quite often you can sort of distort the name of an already established organization, which is relatively easy to pick up. But there's kind of what we call pseudo media now. And pseudo media now is where anybody can, in effect, set a what ostensibly looks like a media news outlet, which picks the same kind of narratives as mainstream media and presents the same kind of information, and then just systemically starts injecting more and more polarizing information about a particular issue. And I think this is particularly impactful for the younger generation, because the older generation, you know, if you forgive me, Steve, like you and me, we know, we have grown up, we know what established media channels look like. We know what the BBC is. We know what Sky is. We know what the Daily Telegraph, we know what the Guardian is. We know all those established media channels. But if you are growing up and you've always digested information in a different way, you don't know the difference between the Washington Post and the Washington Recorder, do you? And if the Washington Recorder right. looks very similar and it's an online information feed and it digests you, it gives you the information you want and starts feeding you the information you want, then that's what happens. So I think we always have to bear in mind, and I think it is a very boring middle-aged thing to say, check your sources, check what you're reading, and then you can start today. Who are the journalists? How long has this media outlet been going? What's the readership? How much readership does it have? And that does sound very dull, but it's actually the only way, and this comes back down to my biggest bee in my bonnet, which is the educational system and how do we start educating people both at a technical level and an awareness level. Then you can start determining what are genuine, balanced media outlets that do give a balanced view of an issue and what are pushing you further and further and further down the line. So sometimes they're quite easy to detect, but actually sometimes they're less easy to detect, and they can then pick up their own following, and that following itself picks up its own momentum, and then quotes from this media are then spread on different social media channels, on different platforms, and then they get that organic growth and then they become real, if you like, to a large population. And I think, as I said before, that manifested itself very strongly, I think, in the American elections 4 years ago.
Yeah, it certainly did. Now, no podcast, no conversation these days is complete without touching on AI. So let's talk about AI. How do you see that being utilized going forward by threat actors? And what specific threats do you think AI might pose within the context of some of the things we've just been talking about, but more broadly than that as well? Where are you on this whole AI spectrum, if you like?
I think AI, once again, can become quite a polarizing discussion. AI at one level becomes this sort of massive malevolent threat, which is going to systemically destroy the world as we know it and take over the world and make humans irrelevant. At the other end of the spectrum, there is it's just a fad, isn't it? It's just another name. It's just, where do I sit on this? Look, whatever you call it, AI or machine learning or any kind of technical advancement, the applications of this capability do, over the medium to long term, have a major impact both on the more traditional cybersecurity threat that we've spoken about and the mis- and disinformation threat. It's still relatively new. It's still in the foothills. It's still relatively easy to detect. But we would be silly if we took our mind off it. So if I look at, once again, go back to the electoral point that you raised before, do I see AI mis- and disinformation becoming a systemic threat in the mis- and disinformation? Not really. I think you'll get a couple of kind of faked images. You'll probably get a little bit of allegations of voice interviews or voice statements coming out. But I do not think they'll be systemic. As I said, actually, mis- and disinformation campaigns take a long time to manifest themselves. However, we would be silly to take our eye off it. The capability, we have seen the capability of what we call AI just in the last 6 to 18 months alone, from almost nothing to some of the kind of more advanced elements of GDP and image manipulation. But I do see it becoming a tool, because it's a tool which can self-learn, it can self-improve in all of those messages, which is, for example, promulgating false media, or it's about being able to look at and identify vulnerabilities in systems and be able to self-write code to be able to overcome them. So we must keep AI at the forefront of our evolution and understanding of the threat. Do I think it is a major mainstream security threat in 2024? No. I think it has elements of it. It certainly does in the mainstream criminal world, which I'll come back to in a minute, because I think that's quite key from a societal level. But from a kind of national security, if you like, security of institutions, is security of provision of services. Do I see it becoming a mainstream threat? No. But do I believe it evolves and can become a mainstream threat if nobody put any countermeasures, which is why we need to understand itself now? Yes. So we still need to be able to put into countermeasures. Where I do see it have a major societal impact at the moment is around the area of crime, low-level crime. And I go back and I draw the corollary. If you remember at the start of the interview, I said the problem was when the cybersecurity issue was that there was a lot of stories around, oh my goodness, you know, gas lines are going to explode, you know, power, you know, nuclear stations are going to collapse. It's all going to be calamitous. And in the meantime, criminals made hay by going cyber attacks with low levels of industry. This same thing will happen with AI in a criminality sense. The benefit of AI is that because it requires less human input, you can scale it. And because most criminal activities take place, and whether those are kind of mainstream phishing events or whether those are sextortion, which is an element which bothers me most, whether it's, you know, the manipulation for ransom, which is just a different version of a new different type of digital ransomware, if you like, that is the area we are going to see it hit hard, and we're going to see it hit fast, and it's going to be very, very low level, but it is going to cause a lot of pain and a lot of angst and a lot of worrying. So I think when we look at AI, we need to recognize it is a potentially long-term larger threat to our institutions, our critical national infrastructure, and we need to put in countermeasures to be able to do that. But we also need to recognize that the most immediate impact on that is around what we call high harms, if you like. And I think that was one of the reasons the UK, over a torturously long period of time, introduced the Online Harms Bill to be able to counter some of those issues. So we need to keep AI in perspective. It is a threat. Of course it is a threat. But I see then when one looks at AI applied in a cybersecurity test, you know, automatic intelligence developing hacking right. techniques, bear in mind, AI is available to both sides. It's not just available to the attackers, it's available to the defenders. So what we are simply going to do is see that same kind of thing that we have in the more human-based countering the cybersecurity threat in an AI space. AI tools will develop to counter AI cybersecurity threats, and so it will go on. Sometimes the bad people will be successful. Most of the time, hopefully, the defenders will be successful. So I think it is a new world, and I think it's a very different world, but I still see the pace of its evolution and the ability to counter it evolve at around the same pace. Because if I go back once again to the earlier days of cybersecurity, when it was still technical but more human-based, the same principle happened. Why have we not had a major cyber attack in this country on our critical national infrastructure? Is it because nobody wants to do it? No, it's because we built our defences to counter the threat based upon sensible information sharing that we touched on right at the very start of the discussion to be able to counter the defences. Sometimes it works, but most of the time it doesn't. So I see that in the AI world happening as well at the big macro problem level. I worry most in the next 2 to 3 years about its lower level impact on the vulnerable in society, just in the same way low level hacking, low level phishing campaigns, low level hackers, theft of money, tying up personal that. I just see it being the same evolution with AI.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that is a very real area of concern when you look at different elements of society, because you know, you make the point that AI systems are available both to the bad guys and the good guys. What is it, do you think, that people can do to, I suppose, safeguard themselves or provide some level of comfort that they're not going to fall victim to some of these sort of lower level AI-based attacks?
I think, first of all, if one looks at the lowest level type AI attacks, they look very much the same as the human low level attacks, right, which is fake emails, badly worded emails, fake calls, phishing attempts. They're still going to look fundamentally the same. And just as human developed ones got better and better and better and better. Yeah. And bearing in mind, even as a user, one shouldn't depend entirely upon the McAfees of this world to be able to generate the most up-to-date bio. But we've always, to be quite frank, looked at the provision of our own technical information security to weed out and to minimally expose us to that kind of threat. But I don't think how it will manifest itself to the user, other than in some very niche areas, which I do worry about a lot, I don't think it's going to manifest itself any different. It may just happen quicker, faster, and it will self-improve. But I still think the core mechanisms we all use at the moment to protect ourselves as individuals and societies as individuals will fundamentally the same. Let me tell you the area I worry about most. And I do worry about this an awful lot because we do at PGI and some of the work we do see it rising. If one looks at the exploitation, and there are two elements to this. One is the exploitation of young, vulnerable people in the area of exploitation. So historically, what used to happen, criminals, low-level criminals, used to coerce individuals, vulnerable people, girls and boys, into discussions, and then used to get involved in exchange of very difficult, very inappropriate images, which were then threatened to be exposed unless a payment was made. Yep. The problem we have now, one can counter that by the education of children, keeping them aware, and so on and so forth. The problem you have now is the ability, because of the availability of imagery online and AI's ability to create imagery, one can create an entirely fabricated image of a vulnerable target and say, this is you, even though it isn't. I am going to publish this to your family's Facebook, to your friend's Facebook. And when you're looking at the most vulnerable in our society, that's a very, very difficult thing to counter, because it doesn't matter whether it's real to whoever sees it, or the fear from the most vulnerable people who see it, they will believe that it is real. And we've seen that. We've seen, particularly, it's a real endemic in the US. There's a lot of teenage suicides over exactly that kind of thing. And that's a real problem. That is one of the really malevolent manifestations of AI, where it can create something which is totally fabricated without necessarily any degree of input from an individual, other than stopping them from ever putting an image of themselves ever up in any photograph, in any image, anywhere. So I think these are the areas we need to focus on most. And once again, that's a societal approach. It's an education of children approach. It's a law enforcement approach. It's a schools approach. It's a community approach. And there are lots of different versions of that kind of example I've spoken about. So that is the kind of horrible, malicious, low-level criminality that I think is going to proceed. Well, wider state and criminal bad actors start developing more sophisticated AI techniques from a hacking point of view or a wider damaging disinformation point of view. That I would think we will see again, just as we did with cyber attacks in the early 20-teens. That will be the growth area of AI.
Yeah, and a pretty miserable growth area too.
Sorry, Steve, it's a fairly miserable thing to finish on, I think.
It is, really. But we'll finish there anyway.
May I make one further point? May I work my really want to make this point. And this is not critical of any society whatsoever, but one of the things that worries me most is, if we talk about polarization, we have, even in the commercial sector, even in industry, even government, we have polarization of technology and people. Quite often, the technical people, if you like, sort of sit over there. The non-technical people sit over here. We try to solve what is a technical problem in a human environment in a very challenging way. And that is primarily because technical people like being very technical and like being in demand. and normal mainstream non-technical people have grown up and their careers have been built and developed in an area where their knowledge of technology needs to be relatively small. And therefore, they like it that way. The problem we fundamentally have is in the UK, our normal societal understanding of technology is woefully low. We all use it. We all use technology till our cows come home. Our knowledge of technology is really, really low. And unless we look at our full end-to-end educative system and start treating technology, and I'm not talking about programming, I'm not talking about getting two-year-olds to write Python. What I'm talking about is start treating the understanding of technology in the same way the understanding of maths and the understanding of English. Until we get that, we will not grow the next generation of people who don't have to be deep technologists, but where everybody has a core understanding of technology, what it means, the infrastructure it's provided on, and how that can manifest itself, both for advantage as well as for threat. And I think we in the UK are a long, long, long way away from being in that position. And if we look at one of our major state protagonists, if you like, China, we look at their educative system and their understanding and their capabilities that they are building. Now, it's done in an entirely different environment, of course, than the liberal democracy we have. But fundamentally, that is an investment in technical knowledge and technical understanding in an entire population from a very young age. And the way that technology is evolving means we have to do that. And if we don't do that, we will fall further and further and further behind. Our skills will still become less and less nuanced and understood. And my risk is that the UK, which is at the moment a leading entity in cybersecurity and countering disinformation, will then end up falling further down and into the second division. And that's a long-term problem, but we really must address that as a matter of urgency, I would suggest.
No, absolutely. You know, if ever there was a case for continued investment in early education in the areas we've just been talking about, I think that's been very well placed there by you. So, Brian, look, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. We've covered a whole range of different areas. Thank you for sharing your insights, your experience, obviously, at GCHQ and also now in the private sector. And I'm sure our listeners will have taken away some really valuable points from that. So, Brian, thank you very much indeed.
Steve, my pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
We'll be back next week with a new episode. If you found value in the conversation today, please rate and review the podcast and share this episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn at Steve Durbin. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.